My name is Liz, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would be also helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Destina and Kobe, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that you learn what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Gulia will read the preamble.
Hello, beautiful people. My name is Gulia. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problems and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There is no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denominations, politics, organizations, or institutions. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me this serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Patrick will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Patrick. I'm an alcoholic. 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons... Microphone. 8, made a list of all persons... Am I too close or too far? Okay. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Vince will read the traditions.
Thank you. My name is Vince Verger. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Melinda.
Thank you. Hi, my name's Melinda. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 27, 2003. My sponsor is Therese P., and I'm here because I don't want to drink today. Thank you for asking me to speak, Eleanor. And I like attention, but this is a little wild, I have to tell you. Wow, there's a lot of people here tonight. But, you know, I think things, and I think a lot of things. And it doesn't always get me places. And my sponsor said to me, Therese P., it's her 11-year anniversary tonight, and she can't be here. But she shot me an email and just said, listen, just let it go. And when I do that, things turn out so much better because, I'm here because I drank and things were really bad. And then when I stopped drinking, I realized I had a really big attitude problem. And things were still bad. I'd never tried to stop drinking before, and I'm going to blank here. When I came in, I was bottoming out about 4 years ago, and my life was unmanageable. It wasn't always that way. I need a drink already. Some things never change. So I come from a very loving, consistent home. Both my parents... they met in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never seen them drink. I'm blessed. They realized that they didn't want to be married, and that was fine. So they married two other people in Alcoholics Anonymous. That made drinking and sneaking really important. You know, I had to lie. I had to learn how to lie at an early age. And no matter how many times I said, I won't drink, I'm not going to, you know, because I'd heard about the wreckage that alcoholism and alcohol had caused. I swore, I was like, I'm never, ever going to drink. And I held out as long as I could. And when I was about 14, I just, you know, it was there and I'd had those feelings that I've heard so many times. I mean, I'm a drunk, like I'm garden variety. I didn't feel like I fit in. I didn't, and there was an opportunity for me to bond with some of the girls in my class in high school, who I so desperately wanted to be friends with. And so I took that, you know, I took that chance, and nothing bad happened. I mean, I actually had about 2 beers, and I was like, well, what's all the fuss about? And, you know, and they're tanked, and I'm like, and then? You know, because I really honestly believe from the get-go, I mean, aside from, you know, from my parents being alcoholics, like, I exhibited a lot of the isms from very early on. Even as a little girl, I remember, no matter how many times people, you know, invited me places and you know, asked me to do things, like, I didn't feel like I fit right. I just didn't fit. And I was scared of that, so I pretended a lot. And I overcompensated a lot. And I carried those, you know, through until I stopped drinking when I was almost 27 years old. And my parents were very consistent and very loving, very supportive. And my drinking was ruined because I had heard about all of the things that had happened. You know, and I'm very much my mother's daughter. And we actually share a lot of similar drinking stories, just different years. And by the time I got to high school, I was drinking unmanageably. Warm beers under the bed, sneaking out, driving drunk before I ever had a license. I got arrested, but I was a good girl. I was very responsible. I had got good grades. I was on the field hockey team. I played lacrosse. I played volleyball, and it was manageable. I had to grow up really... I wanted to grow up. I wanted to be taken seriously. I wanted to fit in. And when I was 14, my stepfather was diagnosed with cancer. And over 4 years, he got sicker and sicker. And that made me really mad. You know, a lot of things made me mad when I was little because I didn't understand them. And I now know that this is a disease of perception. And from the get-go, my thinking was just off. You know, and further on in my story, like, it was a lot of the fuel for my drinking. And I was mad, and I renounced any kind of God. My dad is, and my stepmom were religious and spiritual in an AA, and my mom was just more of the spiritual, and that was fine. And I was mad at my dad for whatever, you know, leaving and coming back and all these things. And thank you. And so I had 5 minutes that threw me off there. I just drank. That's why I'm here. I just drank. And in college, my stepfather died, and that hurt a lot. And I drank over that. And when I got to college, I was grieving and excited because I could drink the way I wanted to without having to see my mother and see, you know, the grieving in her face and, you know, try and hide my alcoholism. And through college, things got really bad, and I became a suicidal drunk. And I entertain bad relationships, and I also could still have periods of control, so I never quite understood what the deal was. So by the time I graduated college, I moved to New York. My mom had moved here. I was drinking all the time. Met the love of my life, I thought, and we partied. We just partied, and life got fun again, because going from all this grieving and all this drama, I caused a lot of drama, and then coming here, and I got into the club scene. And if any of you have been in the club scene, you know what that's like, and it's very exciting. And it brought me to my knees really quickly. I do want to talk about solution here. So basically, that's the way it was. It got worse and worse and worse. And exactly 4 years ago, I was skidding in here on my face. I was lonely. I was suicidal. I was depressed. And I was angry. I was angry, and I didn't understand what was going on, because I never thought that I would be this way. I was really remorseful and really guilty, because I'd caused a lot of wreckage myself. All that stuff that my parents talked about, that was me. And I was ashamed. So I drank. I couldn't make it to New Year's. It was 2 days after Christmas, and I was with my family, and the door was opened. I was at dinner with my mother and my brother, who had just gone through rehab, and that kind of set off some bells in my head. And I said, you know, Mom, I had a drug problem. And she listened, and then she let me talk, and then said, so what about your drinking? I went, oh, man. Like, because, you know, I thought it was everything else. I was constantly blaming other things for the reasons I acted the way I did. But in the back of my brain, I knew, you know, and I drank that away, because all that chatter, God, the chatter. And so it kind of really picked up really quickly after that. I went to rehab 28 days, and I don't know. I'd never really tried to stop drinking before. Once when I was 20, I told a boyfriend that I think I had a drinking problem, but I was trying to get out of something that I had done that was really embarrassing, and that was sort of my scapegoat, and we never spoke of it again. And I came back. I went to rehab in Seattle because the family members in the program out there, and was in the health care field and could get me into rehab. I was a bartender. I had no health insurance. And I went there for 28 days, and I learned about alcoholism, and I ate for the first time in like 5 years. No, really, like I ate 3 meals a day, probably like 5 meals, let's be honest, because I was like craving these nutrients, like in my body and my brain, and I was safe from myself, you know, because the whole time along I'd been trying to heal my sick mind with my sick mind, and that didn't work. And I couldn't let anybody else in to know what was going on. And the more I loved you, the further I pushed you away. Like I couldn't have you that close. It was too painful. So it's kind of taken off from there. I came in on the young people's circuit. I went to IKIPA, and I think it was Orlando. I greeted for like 2 months at a young people's meeting down on the Lower East Side, and I just hugged people as they walked by. Some of them were going to the meeting, some of them weren't, but they got their hug for the day. So spread peace, love, love. Oh, I have a minute. Oh my gosh. Okay, so things have gotten really amazing. I have 4 amazing, beautiful, wonderful sponsees that help me all the time. I pray, I meditate. I have a higher power in my life. 10 minutes went so fast. Higher power that just protects me. Just protects me. And all of you. You're just amazing. And thank you for my sobriety.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Steve.
Thank you. My name's Steve. I'm an alcoholic. I cannot believe this is so amazing for me because like 4 years ago, I've been here for 4 years. That's like mind-blowing in and of itself. And I remember when I came in, I was so sick and so, you know, full of self-centered fear. And I still have all that stuff, but I'm getting better because I'm working this program. But I'm so much more comfortable in my skin today, so much more. You know, I'm just looking forward to speaking to all of you guys, especially the newcomer. And, you know, I asked God before I came up here, just let me enjoy this, you know? Let me enjoy it. And I just don't want to say stuff that's for me and want to look good and all this other junk. Hopefully something I can say will help somebody. You know, that's really, I'm trying to get out of that. That's me healing from alcoholism. All right. Enough of that stuff. what a preamble, huh? All right. The first thing I think I'd like to talk about is that the topic for the Sunday meeting was service. And one of my sober brothers and I were hanging out after the meeting, and we were talking about service. And the topic of it went in a place that I always thought of in my head, but I never really discussed with anyone else. And I really, this is just me. This is not our literature speaking. I really believe the only reason I'm alive or sober today is because God knows I'm willing to help other people. I really believe that. I think that the only reason we're sober at all is to be of service. I shouldn't be here. I should be dead or I should be in a mental institution. That's a fact. And if I don't serve, if I don't help other people, if I don't talk to the newcomer, if I don't try to be kind in life and be tolerant of people that are yelling, screaming in my face, and I'm resentful, I'm going to get angry, I'm get in my head, I'm going to push God away, and I'm going to drink. And if I drink, I'm dead. That's the end of the story. So it's quite obvious to me that whether my theory is correct or not, the bottom line is I have to live a life of service, you know. And that means that what I'm doing right now, what I'm talking about here, is really, for the newcomer, I know there's a bunch of you guys out there. Every time I come, going for 4 years, there's so many people raising their hands. I got 3 days, I got 40 days, I got 60 days. We're here to help you, because by helping you, we help ourselves. That's just how it works. Now, I got to tell you that, I'll share a little story. My very, very first meeting was at a place called Hazelden on 17th Street between 2nd and 3rd, and it's not there anymore. I don't really know what they did with it, but this is back about 6 years ago, 6.5 years ago. And just to preface it by saying that my first love was music. It's really probably saved my butt. You know, it was the one thing God gave me that gave me some joy and pleasure while I was a very, very sick and very unhappy and sad child. And I walked into this room, and I was obviously very afraid. You know, it was my first meeting, and I'm scared out of my mind. I don't know what to expect. And I look on the wall, and there's a plaque, and there's a guitar on the plaque. And underneath it, it says, the Eric Clapton Room. I'm like, I'm home. This is where I belong, you know? And I'm not saying that, I mean, it's funny, it's cute, you know, but it's what that really did for me was amazing because it made me feel safe, you know, and God gave me a gift. It's like, cool people come here. It's going to be all right, you know? You can chill with this. I needed that, you know? And I didn't understand anything that was being told me. I didn't understand anything at all. You know, I'll tell you, the newcomer, what I did understand. I understood, and I heard a lot that day. I understood hopelessness, helplessness, lack of self-esteem, self-hatred, fear, not knowing what's going to happen, not being able to call any shots in your life. I understood all of that. And because I understood it, it really made me more scared than I was before I walked in. But I have to tell you that there was something inside of me that knew it could work, you know? As sick as I was 44 years old when I got sober. And I got to tell you, I'm not on the pity pot here. I've had great moments in that 44 years, some wonderful moments. You know, I was even married and had some wonderful times with my ex-wife. Did a lot of fun things. I had some fun with my... Oh, stop it. This is stream of consciousness. You never know what's coming up. The bottom line is I had some fun times, but I was very unhappy and very miserable my whole life. I really was. I was a very, very sad and sick person. It was all about not being good enough, you know, just not being good enough. But I really believed that there was something that could help me, you know. My five, thank you. And I don't know where that came from. And at first, I knew it worked. I saw it work in other people. You know, I mean, I could see people, oh, I got 10 years, and there you are having a wonderful life. You know, you've recovered. You know, you feel good about yourself. You know how to clean up. You know how to dress right. You know how to speak right to people. You can hold a conversation. You know, you can hold down a job, get promotions, have a family, have a life. You know, you were lying in the gutter, you know, drooling on yourself. Okay, so obviously this works. But I thought I was so sick that it wouldn't work for me. I really believe that. And it took me a long, long time to change my idea about that. But what I'd like to say to the newcomers is that it works. It really, really does. You know, if you're really, really new, you're not going to get a lot of the stuff we're talking about. This is the most incredible group in Alcoholics Anonymous, in my opinion. It's all about the solution. It's full of people that know the Big Book inside and out. They're here to help you because they want to help you, because they have a heart and they love you, and not because they're looking to get something from you or to look good or to sound good. You're here with people that are going to help you get your lives together, help you have some self-esteem, help you have the things in life that you always wanted to have but never could because you drank. Now, I never knew how I was supposed to live without alcohol. I mean, I haven't had a drink in over 6 years, and sometimes it astounds me that I've made it 6 years without a drink, because I was really an unrecovered alcoholic for at least the first 2.5, 3 years of my sobriety. But before I stopped drinking, I needed alcohol to function on all levels. You know, for me, one of the things that makes me an alcoholic, and this is a personal opinion, is what alcohol does for me. You know, I mean, just the social anxiety part of my disease was a part. I go to a party, I'm by myself, I want to meet a girl, dance, whatever, and I'm so afraid I can't even speak to anybody, let alone a nice girl. I'm shaking, I'm stammering, I'm, you know, all that stuff. I have one drink, and I mean one drink. It's gone, completely gone. Like it never existed. And I'm not talking about, it's so nice to see people going like this. It's, the relating part is awesome. I'm not talking about like this false sense of, you know, oh, I'm cool and all this. I'm not talking about that at all. I'm talking about, oh, here I am. This is really me. And the truth of it was really me. What it did, it removed the lie of alcoholism in my mind that I'm not good enough, that I'm not valuable enough, I'm not attractive enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm so damaged you don't want to talk to me. This is the sickness of alcoholism in my head. And when I had a drink, it went away. And if I had five drinks, it went away even five times better. You know, I'm serious. And I remember having six Heinekens, and I was zen. I wasn't drunk. I was zen, man. I was not drunk. I was me. I was completely me. And that was killing me. At the end of my run, do you know how much time I have left? Okay, thank you. At the end of my run, I was locked in my room for 8 months. I was drinking up a storm, doing other substances. I almost died. I almost died. That was it for me. There was no more drinking. There was no more zen. There was no more, this is a solution. It was death for me. It was over. Or I was going to end up in an institution. There was no solution anymore. I was going to die. I had no choice but to come here. And I was willing to be dry rather than to die. And that's what I did for 3 years. There's a solution here, guys. If you're new, you got to get a home group. You got to have a group of people, thank you, that love you, that are going to stick by you, make sure you're okay. I recommend this one, but that's me. You got to get a sponsor, somebody who has been through the 12 steps, who has them in their life, who actually lives them, who actually prays every day and meditates every day, that takes inventory, personal inventory, and corrects their mistakes, has a relationship with God, you know? I'm getting nailed over here, you guys. Somebody that lives a life with a relationship with God. That's the bottom line. The bottom line for me, our book says this. The purpose of this book is to find a power greater than yourself that can solve all of your problems. That's what I'm seeking in this room. I'm seeking a way to have a relationship with a higher power I call God. When I stay close to that higher power, I feel good about myself. I feel worthy. I want to help other people. I want to be of service in life. Thank you. And when I don't, I'm dead. You guys have really helped save my life. Thank you very much.
And our main speaker tonight is Nadine.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. I'm Nadine Rizzo. I'm an alcoholic. My sober date is August 10th, 1987, and my home group is Long Beach, West End, and Long Beach, Long Island. I want to thank Helen for asking me to come up here. When I first met Helen, I was told she was the woman I needed to speak to go to Rikers. I was all over her before the meeting was even over. I was like, I want to go. And I think she was a little afraid of me, but she was like, okay, I'll take your information. And the reason why I wanted to go to Rikers is because I believe in service. But I'll just tell you a little bit about what my life was like before I got here. And I was told to be honest because there's people here that witnessed my drinking. But I was like, hello, look at the place we're in. I think I'll be honest. I could tell her story just as well as she could tell mine, though. So I started drinking when I was 12 years old. Prior to that, I never thought about it. It was not something that I looked at and said, oh, I can't wait to try that, as where my twin sister was sitting on Daddy's lap drinking his Schlitz or Schaefer or whatever that was. And she was also sitting on Grandpa's lap trying his Creme de Mint. And I was like, had no desire. But when I was 12 and I was up the block with the boys, because I always hung with the boys, and they were drinking a pint of Jack Daniels, I said, give me that. And I finished it. And I could still bring it back as if it was yesterday, you know, like that warmth and then the burn and then the, you know. And I drank like that until I stopped drinking when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And the way I drank was from the bottle to be drunk. I felt like I had this out-of-body experience that I was like over here watching what was going on over there, and I wanted to be a part of it so badly that I drank like that until I stopped. I never thought I had a problem. If you had a problem, well, there's the door. But I got home that night, and my mother said, I was vomiting, and she's like, next time stick to soda, you won't get so sick. When I was done vomiting, I came downstairs. I said, you know, can I, my curfew's not up, can I go back? So there was no consequences to my drinking that night. There was no problem as far as I was concerned. I saw my parents drinking. That was just a very normal thing in my house. I'm not an alcoholic because my father is. I'm not an alcoholic because I was abused as a kid. I'm not an alcoholic for any other reason that I picked up in a drink at the age of 12 and liked it and wanted more of that effect. That's why I'm an alcoholic. My life as an alcoholic was not always so pleasant. Like I said, I have a twin sister. My mother died when we were 14, and I was pissed that God took her from me. She was my ally. My father and I did not like each other, and it was pretty known that we didn't like each other. I really had no respect for him because he was not a good father. I've been told to refrain from cursing. So, he was not a very good father to me. My twin sister, on the other hand, reaped the benefits of him being a good father, I guess. Because I've since told her that he did this, this, and this. And she's like, no, he didn't. I was like, you were raised in La La Land then, because the house I was raised in, I was getting abused verbally and somewhat physically. My father, his words of wisdom after my mother died was, you'd be so pretty if you just didn't have such a big ass. Here comes Thunder Thighs. You know, those were my dad's words of wisdom to me. And I have to tell you, I'm at my heaviest now. I don't think I weighed more than 105 pounds all through my drinking days. So it was, you know, and that was the kind things he said to me. Those were his loving words to me. So, you know, I was a barroom drinker. I had fake ID when I was 14 or 15. I found it in the girls' locker room of my middle school, and I snatched it up, and that was my home ticket. That was it. I was like, yes, I could finally go where my father doesn't go. Because he told his also words of wisdom is, don't go over the Long Beach Bridge. They have roadblocks. So I stayed north of the bridge, and I found places that would serve me. And it wasn't difficult. We just went with, like, a crowd, and we went to the old man bars. And, you know, my favorite haunt was this little bar in Oceanside, and there was always an old guy, Buddy, sitting in the corner, and he had his change on the bar, and it was 35-cent tap beers, and he would push his change towards the bartender, and say, okay, I'll have another. And you know what? It was heaven to me, because nobody ever said, what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? You know, nobody ever questioned me. It was my bar. You know, I drank from a bottle. I was not a tap beer drinker because I didn't trust that they sanitized the water. So it was always from a bottle. And you know what? My father came in there a couple of times, and I locked myself in the bathroom because I didn't want to be drinking with him. I didn't like him. I didn't want to socialize with him. Get him out of here, or I'm staying in the bathroom. And the bartender asked him to leave. Another time, my father came in, and he engaged in a conversation I was already in the middle of, and he thought I was cursing at him, so he smacked me across the face. I smacked him right back. I said, listen to me. Read my lips. If you ever touch me again, I will kill you, and then I'll call the police. He never laid a hand on me again. I was 19. I was done with the abuse. But, you know, at that point of my life, at the ripe old age of 19, my only dream in life was to have a brass nameplate on the bar. Nadine sits here, get up. And and I say that because I saw it in a bar. You know, Carl sits here, or this is Carl C to something. And I went to school with the owner of that bar, and I asked him if he still had that section of bar. He told me he would look for it. I don't know why I want it, but... So anyway, at the ripe old age of 19, that was my only hopes and dreams. Nobody pushed me to go to college. Nobody pushed me for anything. I was working in a movie theater. I was managing, at the time, it was 3 movie theaters. I was the general manager. And I just, this was okay, you know. My sister was a bartender or a waitress or something. And my family was in the restaurant business. And this is just okay, you know. There was no when I'm 20 or when I'm 30 or, you know, when I get up and brush my teeth, you know, because personal hygiene was not on the top of the priority list, I must tell you. I was living in a first-floor walk-up roach-infested apartment in downtown Oceanside, I like to say. And my girlfriend, who's here tonight, was my roommate. And... you know, that was one of my low points of my life from what she told me. I thought it was just normal. I was paying $185 of my share of rent. I was making close to $300 a week, and I couldn't afford rent. My drinking was my priority, and I say that with absolute all honesty that I could muster up. My drinking came first, and if you were in my way of my drink, I... moved you. I didn't care how big you were or how mean you looked or what color you were. If you were in the way of me and my drink, you were moved. And I didn't drink in nice places. I didn't drink in fancy places. I didn't have to worry about, you know, my pinky being out. I drank from a bottle. And, you know, when I was living in this lovely apartment, our biggest priority was who's going to be blessed with our company tonight? You know, who's going to be the fortunate few to get us for their company? I mean, talk about an ego. But, you know, so I lived there for, I don't know, not long, less than a year. And I couldn't afford rent. And my maternal grandmother invited me to go on a very elaborate vacation to Hawaii and California. And I knew I could not afford rent and go away. It was an all-expense-paid vacation, and I couldn't afford to go away. Because my drinking was my priority. And if I'm going to Hawaii, you know, they sell some really good stuff over there that I need to bring home and sell for my drinking. That was my priority. And, you know, I could tell you that Maui was beautiful, but I don't really remember it. And I did bring stuff home, and it was the only bag that got checked in customs. And I was with my white-gloved grandmother that was best friends with the Monsignor of the church we were raised in. And my grandfather was off somewhere else, and he was already, prior to this, being arrested for growing marijuana, but I wasn't aware of that until much later on in life. And I was like, I'm stuck with Granny. Great. And I'm going to get arrested for bringing pot home. I swore I would never smoke it again, and I never did, but that stuff stayed in my drawer for I don't know how long, and I wasn't caught, and I thank God that I didn't get caught. That was an honest thank you, and I don't think I touched it after that, but it stayed in my drawer until I got sober, and go figure. So anyway, this was my priorities of my life. It wasn't like, oh, wow, I'm going on this fabulous vacation. Oh, no, how am I going to afford it? That was it. You know, I was making some decent money at the, 20 and 21 years old. And I moved back into my father's house, and there was no room for me to move back into because I couldn't afford rent and go on this vacation. So I moved back to my father's house, and he was already renting my room to my girlfriend that's here, her roommate from college. And my sister was in the other room, so we put up a ramo-shamo wall in the dining room, and I now slept in the dining room. This is just, it was normal to me, the insanity that I was raised with, and it was just so normal. Like, okay, we'll put up some sheetrock and call it a room. And I stayed there again for under a year, and I was the only one, I think, that paid rent in that house. And that rent, all that rent went to my father's drinking money. And he said I was the most responsible in the house. Go figure. He never liked me, but I'm going to be the most responsible in the house. So I paid him rent and moved out as quickly as I could. And I moved into what is, my present house. I moved in with... this man, he came into the bar where I was drinking at the time and said, I'm on the wagon. I was like, that's good because you really have a problem. And I knew him from, he used to drink in my uncle's restaurant, and he drank with my father and he drank with my great-grandfather, and I know him for many years. I met him when I was 14 years old, and everybody knew he was at the bar because he was such a big drinker. So I was right there, yeah, good, I'm glad you're on the wagon, you need it. And I told him if he ever wanted to come visit me at the movies, I work at the movies. And he did. He actually came by my father's house and asked me if I wanted to go out. And I went, okay, why? You know, like I really had no clue. And the reason why I had no clue, he was not my type of man that I dated. He drove a car, he had a job, and he had all his teeth. So I very quizzical, why do you want to go out with me? But okay, we'll go out. He was a nice guy, you know, like that's the way I looked at it. And he picked me up. He told me he'd be there at midnight because I got off at midnight. He was there at 5:02. I was shocked. You're on time. Nobody in my life is ever on time. If I told you I'd meet you at 11 on Tuesday, I might show up at 11 p.m. or 11 a.m. on another week. I was like, I said 11 on Tuesday. I didn't tell you which day, which Tuesday. But he was on time, so I was shocked. And then we went out again, and I was again, what's up with this guy? He's dropping me at the door, giving me a kiss goodnight, and driving away. I'm like, see ya, calling the ex-boyfriend, going there, finishing the party with the case of beer and the other stuff, you know? And I couldn't understand why this guy wanted to date me. He was on the wagon. Good for you. Well, 3 or 4 weeks into dating him, I said to my girlfriend, I'm going to marry him. She goes, Nadine, he's not divorced. I said, minor problem. You know, whatever. And he was going to AA, okay? So here's the thing. He's going to AA. And I was like, so woohoo, good for you. When he celebrated 90 days, I sent him flowers. I was like, you know, I didn't know anything about AA other than he went and he needed it. And I was now living with him on his 90th day because, you know what, I'm either staying here or going back home. I can't be doing this back and forth thing. And he says, what's going to be different? I was like, listen, I don't cook and I don't make the bed every day. If you want something else, you're going to have to hire somebody. And I was 20, 22 maybe. And he said, okay, how about if you move in with me, you go to Al-Anon? I was like, again, with the question mark on my face, all right. Anything to please my man was my next thought in my head. So I went to Al-Anon. You know, and I tried my best. I really did try my best to work the 12 steps and 12 traditions according to the Al-Anon program. while I was controlling my drinking and going to open AA meetings with him, because he never, ever missed an AA meeting, and I never, ever missed the opportunity for a resentment. And we traveled wherever we went, Poconos, Florida to visit mom, whatever. I never missed the opportunity, and he never missed a meeting. And I was like, but look, you got me. Why would you want to go to AA when you got me? He's like, listen, I'm going. You could either come with me and sit in the back. Nobody will know you don't belong. I'm like, that's right, I don't. Let's not forget that. I'm here because you are the alcoholic. He's like, whatever, Nadine, just sit down. So I went to these meetings with him. Some of them were open, some of them were closed, and I just sat in the back. Would you like to read? No, I'm here for him. Would you like to be? No, I'm here for him. He's the alcoholic. I mean, like, it wasn't written all over my face. Because I just came with, you know, I had a half a carafe of wine, or I had two bottles of beer, and, you know, total control. And so after he celebrated his first anniversary, I was like, woohoo. I was resentful. He did not acknowledge me during his first anniversary meeting. And, you know, if it wasn't for me, you know, the great I am. We were in a meeting up in the Poconos, and this old time, I'll never forget him, Roy, one eye, you know, asked me to read. I was like, I am here for him. I am not an alcoholic. He goes, you could still read. No, I can't. I'm out the door with the resentment. And the reason why I couldn't read is because I couldn't read. I did, you know, like, God forbid I should tell anybody, I don't have the ability to read and, you know, the concept or the putting the words together or what, I don't know. But in August, that was in May, June, whatever, by August I was in this meeting and we were in the Poconos and doing, I love this book, you know, doing one of these, acting like, I don't belong, I'm here for him, you know, just following along as they read. And I heard something, hello, clue, and I went to the pamphlet table and I picked up something. Now, I can't read, but I read from Poconos to Island Park, 2.5 hours, trying to read and, you know, comprehend what I was reading. I said, at exit 17 is our exit. Would you drive me to an AA meeting tonight? He went, what? I thought he was going to crash into the overpass. And I didn't know there was meetings everywhere. I thought they were only where he went, so he needed to drive me to a meeting because I'm not going where you go. So he drove me to Long Beach, dropped me off, and said, good luck. I walked down those stairs to Serenity by the Sea, PM. There was somebody at the door and said, welcome, keep coming back. Nobody ever said, keep coming back, you know. So that's what I did. I started my journey of recovery. It took me a while to get the concept of what a sponsor was for, and when I finally got the concept and I asked this woman to be my sponsor, she was about this big, long red nails, big hair, red lips, not anything I would have ever drank with or hung around with, but I wanted what she had, and she had almost 10 years of recovery. I asked her if she would be my sponsor. She says, okay, do what I do. I said, okay, what's that? Sit down, shut up, and listen. I went, listen, honey, you don't know who you're dealing with. She goes, I know I have something you want, and if you want it, you'll do what I do. I was like, okay. So guess what? I sat down and I started to listen, and she gave me the foundation that I still adhere to today. And that was not always the way I behaved in sobriety. For my first 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, I was in meetings, doing service. And you know what? That man and I, we got married, we had a couple of kids, and life got really busy and life took over. And I started to rest on my laurels and unaware of it. In complete and total denial, I'm good, I got it going on, you know. Somewhere around 9 or 10 years, I was bitter, angry, resentful. I hated you. I hated every one of you, and I hated me even more, but I was in denial of that. I thought I had it going on. And right before my 12th anniversary, I quit my now full-time job because I hated my life and those little children that called me mommy and the cat that meowed and my husband that breathed every night when he laid down. I was like, oh, my God. I went to my home group on Long Beach, in Long Beach, on the beach, though, with my girlfriends, and said, I'm going back to AA as soon as they... And I used not a nice word to refer to my children. As soon as they go back to school, I'm going to AA. And my two girlfriends started doing the happy dance. Hallelujah. And I had no clue that I was angry or bitter or resentful. I had no clue. I walked back into Serenity by the Sea, walked down those stairs, found a friend of mine that I still see today, and said, I need a home group. I need a sponsor. I need a group commitment. And I need an institutional commitment. He goes, slow down, Nadine. I said, if I go any slower, I'm walking back up those stairs. I'm either going to kill myself or drink. He said, sit down. I I had a sponsor before the end of that meeting. I was the greeter before the end of that meeting. And that was my home group again. It took me 7 months to get an institutional commitment. I put it out to everyone that would listen that I wanted to speak in the jails or the hospitals or wherever that I wasn't allowed to speak. And to this day, I still, every Friday night, go to Nassau County Jail and speak to the men and tell them that there is a better way of life without alcohol and drugs. I recommitted myself to this program, and that was 9 years ago. And so this is the, you know, this is my foundation. What I learned in my first year is what I behave like today. I have a sponsor that I speak to that has a sponsor that she speaks to. I study this book. I love this book. I study it because it's a text. It's made to be studied. It's not meant to be read like a novel and put down and never looked at again. I can't tell you the stories in it because I have the third edition and I don't know the stories because I study the first 164 pages. I do go to a lot of meetings and I do a lot of service. When Helen asked me to speak here tonight, I was like, yeah, all right, you know. I'll go anywhere for my recovery. I will go anywhere to help anybody with their recovery if it's in my capability, because this program has given me a life that I am not smart enough to have come up with on my own. Okay? I live in a home that when you flick the lights, they go on. You turn on that hot water, you know there's going to be hot water in that shower every morning. What a concept. And if I open that refrigerator and there's no food, it's because I didn't go food shopping. That's the only reason. Otherwise, like, this is not something I lived with growing up, you know. It was a matter of my father, if he chose to pay the oil bill, we had hot water. And if he remembered to pay Lilco, we had electric. So everything I have in my life, I was not raised to have. But I have to thank my maternal grandmother and my grandfather. They gave me some stability, but I was raised by my father, and you know, that's a whole nother story. So anyway, my sister, who I never liked, my father, who didn't like me and I never liked, my sister and I are very, very close friends. She's my twin. She still drinks. That's her problem, not mine. My father, I don't speak to, and that's by his choice, but I haven't said this out loud at all to anybody. I was just told that he had triple bypass surgery a couple of weeks ago. My husband, gotta love him, spoke to my father's stepmother and got my father's address, and my husband brought home a card, a sympathy card, and said, address it, write it to him. I was like, what do I write? Hello? You know, like, I wrote him a card, I signed it, Nadine, and from what I understand, he was very happy that he got a card from me. I was like, there was no love or affection in it. I just did it because my husband told me to. But that's AA, taught me, you know, all right, I could put a stamp on the envelope. Maybe he is worth 41 cents, but, you know, that's more than he gave me growing up, you know, and I have to be the shining example of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I might be the only example of the big book somebody meets tonight. I might be the only example that somebody meets out on the street of as an alcoholic in recovery. I want it to be a positive example, you know, and I really do try and refrain from cursing when I'm in front of an AA meeting, because when I first got sober after my first anniversary, somebody came up to me and says, Nadine, thank you, congratulations, you're sober a year now, you could stop vomiting and leave the curse words outside. I don't effing curse that much, what's your effing problem? You know, I really had no clue I cursed, you know, it was just so part of my nature. So I try and present myself in a manner that somebody, a newcomer, maybe somebody will go, wow, if she could stay sober, maybe I can too. And that doesn't mean a woman. It could be a man too. I don't care who you are. If I could be of service, if I could be of help, then like he said, that's why I come here. I come here to keep my own self sober. You know, it's too easy for me to rest on my laurels. It's too easy to say, oh, you know what, it's really cold out. I don't feel like going to Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. And you know what? I didn't do that last night. I stayed home with my kid. My 16-year-old says, Mommy, watch the movie with me. I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to take this opportunity while I can. And I did stay home, but I knew I was coming here tonight. And I know, without a shadow of a doubt, I'm going to a meeting on Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday. You know, I plan my meetings the same way I plan my drink. Everything in my life is sober, and I appreciate Melinda sharing that her parents were sober. My children, God bless, have never seen me or their father drunk. You know, a few years ago, I hated my husband so much I told him I wanted a divorce. You know, we're not divorced. That is by true a miracle. And I'm going to share with you how my miracle came to be. 9 years ago, I hated my husband. And he's a devout Catholic, and he asked me to go to church with him because it would be, you know, what we told the children when we raised them in this Catholic church. I was like, fine, I'll go. You know, that's how angry I was, but I didn't know it. And I'm sitting in the pew, and my husband, for some reason, was up on the altar. And I looked up at the crucifix behind the altar, and I said, you got 6 months, and if I don't feel you, I am out of here. I'm done living like a hypocrite. Well, I guess that was an honest prayer because Jesus entered my heart before Catholic Mass was over. So I got to tell you that my Savior is Jesus Christ and Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't go anywhere without either one of them being right there with me. So 4 years ago, I told my husband I wanted a divorce. We were in the proceedings of the divorce. A lot of money was spent on this divorce, and I was done speaking to him. So I told him I will speak to a therapist or an attorney or anybody else present. And this therapist asked me if I would just give it the summer. Just put it off for the summer. Just stop the divorce proceedings for the summer. I was like, I'm done. I hate this guy. I'm done. Second session, because we were like mediating, I was like, fine. I was sitting next to the wall and I went like this. Who just said fine? My husband's doing the happy dance. She's going to give me the summer. I was like, oh my Lord, what did I just get myself into? I want this man out of my life, and now I just told him I wouldn't divorce him. I could say I'm very, very blessed that I'm not divorced from my husband. You know, that is an absolute miracle. Miracle of this program and my higher power. Be careful what you pray for. You will get it. You might not like it, but you'll get it. You might not think you want it, but you'll get it. And it might not be in the form that you're ready to handle, but God is going to give it to you, you know? And that's a scary thing. Be careful what you pray for. So when I was sitting here before going, oh my Lord, I can't believe I'm in the church. I can't believe there's so many people here. God, please speak through me. And not let me be happy, not let me say anything wonderful, but Lord, if there's somebody in this room that I could help tonight, please give me the words to speak. Because if you're getting me, you better run for the hills. You better hope I'm praying, because you want Jesus to be talking through me and not Nadine talking to you, you know. That's a good thing. That's a good thing, because when I wasn't working this program, you got me, and it was a nasty, negative thing. So I'm going to end on this, and I try and always share this in a beginner's meeting, that if you're talking to yourself, like I often do, it's always negative. I'm usually talking to an idiot about an asshole, so stop. Okay? Thank you.